Johannes Kepler, Epitome of Copernican Astronomy, Book 4, 1621. Before we invented civilization, our ancestors lived mainly in the open, out under the sky. Before we devised artificial lights and atmospheric pollution and modern forms of nocturnal entertainment, we watched the stars. There were practical, calendrical reasons, of course, but there was more to it than that. Even today, the most jaded city dweller can be unexpectedly moved upon encountering a clear night sky studded with thousands of twinkling stars. When it happens to me after all these years, it still takes my breath away. In every culture, the sky and the religious impulse are intertwined. I lie back in an open field and the sky surrounds me. I'm overpowered by its scale. It's so vast and so far away that my own insignificance becomes palpable. But I don't feel rejected by the sky. I'm a part of it. Tiny, to be sure, but everything is tiny compared to that overwhelming immensity. And when I concentrate on the stars, the planets, and their motions, I have an irresistible sense of machinery, clockwork, elegant precision working on a scale that, however lofty our aspirations, dwarfs and humbles us. Most of the great inventions in human history, from stone tools and the domestication of fire to written language, were made by unknown benefactors. Our institutional memory of long-gone events is feeble. We do not know the name of that ancestor who first noted that planets were different from stars. She or he must have lived tens, perhaps even hundreds of thousands of years ago. But eventually, people all over the world understood that five, no more, of the bright points of light that grace the night sky break lockstep with the others over a period of months, moving strangely, almost as if they had minds of their own. Sharing the odd apparent motion of these planets were the sun and moon, making seven wandering bodies in all. These seven were important to the ancients, and they named them after gods. Not any old gods, but the main gods. The chief gods, the ones who tell other gods and mortals what to do. One of the planets, bright and slow-moving, was named by the Babylonians after Marduk, by the Norse after Odin, by the Greeks after Zeus, and by the Romans after Jupiter, in each case, the king of the gods. The faint, fast-moving one that was never far from the sun, the Romans named Mercury, after the messenger of the gods. The most brilliant of them was named Venus, after the goddess of love and beauty. The blood-red one, Mars, after the god of war. And the most sluggish of the bunch, Saturn, after the god of time. These metaphors and allusions were the best our ancestors could do. They possessed no scientific instruments beyond the naked eye. They were confined to the earth. And they had no idea that it too is a planet. There was one moment in the last 4,000 years when all seven of these celestial bodies were clustered tightly together. Just before dawn, on March 4th, 1953, B.C., the crescent moon was at the horizon. Venus, Mercury, Mars, Saturn, and Jupiter were strung out like jewels on a necklace near the great square in the constellation Pegasus, near the spot from which in our time the Perseid meteor shower emanates. Even casual watchers of the sky must have been transfixed by the event. What was it? A communion of the gods? According to the astronomer David Pankinier of Lehigh University and later Kevin Pang of JPL, this event was the starting point for the planetary cycles of the ancient Chinese astronomers. There is no other time in the last 4,000 years or in the next when the dance of the planets around the sun brings them so close together from the vantage point of Earth. But on May 5th, 2000, all seven will be visible in the same part of the sky, although some at dawn and some at dusk, and about 10 times more spread out than on that late winter morning in 1953 BC. Still, it's probably a good night for a party. When it got to be time to design the week, a period of time unlike the day, month, and the year, with no intrinsic astronomical significance, it was assigned 7 days, each named after one of the seven anomalous lights in the sky. We can readily make out the remnants of this convention. In English, Saturday is Saturn's day. Sunday and Moon Day are clear enough. Tuesday through Friday are named after the gods of the Saxon and kindred Teutonic invaders of Celtic and Roman Britain. Wednesday, for example, is Odin's or Woden's day, which would be more apparent if we pronounced it as it's spelled, W-E-D-N's day. Thursday is Thor's day. Friday is the day of Freya, goddess of love. The last day of the week stayed Roman. The rest of it became German. In all Romance languages such as French, Spanish, and Italian, the connection is still more obvious because they all derive from ancient Latin, in which the days of the week were named, in order beginning with Sunday, after the Sun, the Moon, Mars, Mercury, Jupiter, Venus, and Saturn. The Sun's day became the Lord's day. They could have named the days in order of the brightness of the corresponding astronomical bodies, the Sun, the Moon, Venus, Jupiter, Mars, Saturn, Mercury, and thus Sunday, Monday, Friday, Thursday, Tuesday, Saturday, Wednesday. But they did not. If the days of the week in Romance languages had been ordered by distance from the Sun, the sequence would be Sunday, Wednesday, Friday, Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday. No one knew the order of the planets, though, back when we were naming planets, gods, and days of the week. The ordering of the days of the week seems arbitrary, although perhaps it does acknowledge the primacy of the sun. This collection of seven gods, 7 days, and 7 worlds, the sun, the moon, and the 5 wandering planets, entered the perceptions of people everywhere. The number 7 began to acquire supernatural connotations. There were 7 heavens, the transparent spherical shells centered on the earth that were imagined to make these worlds move. The outermost, the 7th heaven, is where the fixed stars were imagined to reside. There are 7 days of creation if we include God's day of rest. 7 orifices to the head, 7 virtues, 7 deadly sins, 7 evil demons in Sumerian myth, 7 vowels in the Greek alphabet, each affiliated with a planetary god, 7 governors of destiny according to the Hermetists, 7 great books of Manichaeism, 7 sacraments, 7 sages of ancient Greece, and 7 alchemical bodies, gold, silver, iron, mercury, lead, tin, and copper. Gold, still associated with the sun, silver with the moon, iron with Mars, etc. The 7th son of a 7th son is endowed with supernatural powers. 7 is a lucky number. In the New Testament's book of Revelation, 7 seals on a scroll are opened, 7 trumpets are sounded, 7 bowls are filled. St. Augustine obscurely argued for the mystic importance of 7 on the grounds that 3 is the first whole number that is odd. What about 1? 4, the first that is even. What about 2? And of these, 7 is composed. And so on. Even in our time, these associations linger. The existence even of the four satellites of Jupiter that Galileo discovered, hardly planets, was disbelieved on the grounds that it challenged the precedence of the number seven. As acceptance of the Copernican system grew, the Earth was added to the list of planets, and the Sun and Moon were removed. Thus, there seemed to be only six planets: Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn. So learned academic arguments were invented showing why there had to be six. For example, six is the first perfect number, equal to the sum of its divisors, 1 + 2 + 3, QED. And anyway, there were only 6 days of creation, not seven. People found ways to accommodate from seven planets to six. As those adept at numerological mysticism adjusted to the Copernican system, this self-indulgent mode of thinking spilled over from planets to moons. The Earth had one moon. Jupiter had the four Galilean moons. That made five. Clearly one was missing. Don't forget, six is the first perfect number. When Huygens discovered Titan in 1655, he and many others convinced themselves that it was the last. Six planets, six moons, and gods in his heaven. The historian of science, I. Bernard Cohen of Harvard University, has pointed out that Huygens actually gave up searching for other moons because it was apparent from such arguments that no more were to be found. 16 years later, ironically, with Huygens in attendance, G.D. Cassini of the Paris Observatory discovered a seventh moon, Iapetus, a bizarre world with one hemisphere black and the other white, in an orbit exterior to Titan's. Shortly after, Cassini discovered Rhea, the next Saturnian moon, interior to Titan. Here was another opportunity for numerology, this time harnessed to the practical task of flattering patrons. Cassini added up the number of planets, six, and the number of satellites, eight, and got 14. Now, it so happened that the man who built Cassini's observatory for him and paid his salary was Louis XIV of France, the Sun King. The astronomer promptly presented these two new moons to his sovereign and proclaimed that Louis's conquests reached to the ends of the solar system. Discreetly, Cassini then backed off from looking for more moons. Cohen suggests he was afraid one more might now offend Louis, a monarch not to be trifled with, who would shortly be throwing his subjects into dungeons for the crime of being Protestants. 12 years later, though, Cassini returned to the search and found, doubtless with a measure of trepidation, another two moons. It is probably a good thing that we have not continued in this vein. Otherwise, France would have been burdened by 70-some-odd Bourbon kings named Louis. When claims of new worlds were made in the late 18th century, the force of such numerological arguments had much dissipated. Still, it was with a real sense of surprise that people heard in 1781 about a new planet discovered through the telescope. New moons were comparatively unimpressive, especially after the first six or eight. But that there were new planets to be found, and that humans had devised the means to do so, were both considered astonishing and properly so. If there is one previously unknown planet, there may be many more, in this solar system and in others. Who can tell what might be found if a multitude of new worlds are hiding in the dark? The discovery was made not even by a professional astronomer, but by William Herschel, a musician whose relatives had come to Britain with the family of another Anglified German, the reigning monarch and future oppressor of the American colonists, George III. It became Herschel's wish to call the planet George, George's star, actually, after his patron. But providentially, the name didn't stick. Astronomers seem to have been very busy buttering up kinks. Instead, the planet that Herschel found is called Uranus, an inexhaustible source of hilarity renewed in each generation of English-speaking nine-year-olds. It is named after the ancient sky god who, according to Greek myth, was Saturn's father and thus the grandfather of the Olympian gods. We no longer consider the sun and moon to be planets and, ignoring the comparatively insignificant asteroids and comets, count Uranus as the seventh planet in order from the sun: Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, Neptune, Pluto. It is the first planet unknown to the ancients. The four outer Jovian planets turn out to be very different from the four inner terrestrial planets. Pluto is a separate case. As the years passed and the quality of astronomical instruments improved, we began to learn more about distant Uranus. What reflects the dim sunlight back to us is no solid surface, but atmosphere and clouds, just as for Titan, Venus, Jupiter, Saturn, and Neptune. The air on Uranus is made of hydrogen and helium, the two simplest gases. Methane and other hydrocarbons are also present. Just below the clouds, visible to earthbound observers, is a massive atmosphere with enormous quantities of ammonia, hydrogen sulfide, and especially water. At depth on Jupiter and Saturn, the pressures are so great that atoms sweat electrons and the air becomes a metal. That does not seem to happen on less massive Uranus because the pressures at depth are less. Still deeper, discovered only by its subtle tugs on Uranus's moons, wholly inaccessible to view, under the crushing weight of the overlying atmosphere, is a rocky surface. A big Earth-like planet is hiding down there, swathed in an immense blanket of air. The Earth's surface temperature is due to the sunlight it intercepts. Turn out the sun and the planet soon chills, not to trifling Antarctic cold, not just so cold that the oceans freeze, but to a cold so intense that the very air precipitates out, forming a 10-meter-thick layer of oxygen and nitrogen snows covering the whole planet. The little bit of energy that trickles up from the Earth's hot interior would be insufficient to melt these snows. For Jupiter, Saturn, and Neptune, it's different. There's about as much heat pouring out from their interiors as they acquire from the warmth of the distant sun. Turn off the sun, and they would be only a little affected. But Uranus is another story. Uranus is an anomaly among the Jovian planets. Uranus is like the Earth. There's very little intrinsic heat pouring out. We have no good understanding of why this should be, why Uranus, which in so many respects is so similar to Neptune, should lack a potent source of internal heat. For this reason, among others, we cannot say we understand what is going on in the deep interiors of these mighty worlds. Uranus is lying on its side as it goes around the sun. In the 1990s, the South Pole is heated by the sun, and it is this pole that Earth-bound observers at the end of the 20th century see when they look at Uranus. It takes Uranus 84 Earth years to make one circuit of the sun. So in the 2030s, the North Pole will be sunward and earthward. In the 2070s, the South Pole will be pointing to the sun once again. In between, Earth-bound astronomers will be looking mainly at equatorial latitudes. All the other planets spin much more upright in their orbits. No one is sure of the reason for Uranus's anomalous spin. The most promising suggestion is that sometime in its early history, billions of years ago, it was struck by a rogue planet, about the size of the Earth, in a highly eccentric orbit. Such a collision, if it ever happened, must have worked much tumult in the Uranus system. For all we know, there may be other vestiges of ancient havoc still left for us to find. But Uranus's remoteness tends to guard its mysteries. In 1977, a team of scientists, led by James Elliott, then of Cornell University, accidentally discovered that, like Saturn, Uranus has rings. The scientists were flying over the Indian Ocean in a special NASA airplane, the Kuiper Airborne Observatory, to witness the passage of Uranus in front of a star. Such passages, or occultations as they're called, happen from time to time, precisely because Uranus slowly moves with respect to the distant stars. The observers were surprised to find that the star winked on and off several times just before it passed behind Uranus and its atmosphere, then several times more just after it emerged. Since the patterns of winking on and off were the same before and after occultation, this finding, and much subsequent work, has led to the discovery of 9 very thin, very dark circumplanetary rings, giving Uranus the appearance of a bullseye in the sky. Surrounding the rings, Earthbound observers understood were the concentric orbits of the 5 moons then known: Miranda, Ariel, Umbriel, Titania, and Oberon. They're named after the characters in Shakespeare's A Midsummer Night's Dream and The Tempest, and in Alexander Pope's The Rape of the Lock. 2 of them were found by Herschel himself. The innermost of the 5, Miranda, was discovered as recently as 1948 by my teacher, G.P. Kuiper. I remember how great an achievement the discovery of a new moon of Uranus was considered back then. The near-infrared light reflected by all 5 moons subsequently revealed the spectral signature of ordinary water ice on their surfaces. And no wonder. Uranus is so far from the sun that it is no brighter there at noontime than it is after sunset on Earth. The temperatures are frigid. Any water must be frozen. A revolution in our understanding of the Uranus system, the planet, its rings, and its moons, began on January 24, 1986. On that day, after a journey of 8.5 years, the Voyager 2 spacecraft sailed very near to Miranda and hit the bullseye in the sky. Uranus' gravity then flung it onto Neptune. The spacecraft returned 4,300 close-up pictures of the Uranus system and a wealth of other data. Uranus was found to be surrounded by an intense radiation belt, electrons and protons trapped by the planet's magnetic field. Voyager flew through this radiation belt, measuring the magnetic field and the trapped charged particles as it went. It also detected, in changing timbres, harmonies, and nuance, but mainly in fortissimo, a cacophony of radio waves generated by the speeding trapped particles. Something similar was discovered on Jupiter and Saturn, and would be later found at Neptune, but always with a theme and counterpoint, characteristic of each world. On Earth, the magnetic and geographical poles are quite close together. On Uranus, the magnetic axis and the axis of rotation are tilted away from each other by some 60 degrees. No one yet understands why. Some have suggested that we are catching Uranus in a reversal of its north and south magnetic poles, as periodically happens on Earth. Others propose that this too is the consequence of that mighty ancient collision that knocked the planet over. But we do not know. Uranus is emitting much more ultraviolet light than it's receiving from the sun. probably generated by charge particles leaking out of the magnetosphere and striking its upper atmosphere. From a vantage point in the Uranus system, the spacecraft examined a bright star winking on and off as the rings of Uranus passed by. New, faint dust bands were found. From the perspective of Earth, the spacecraft passed behind Uranus, so the radio signals it was transmitting back home passed tangentially through the Uranian atmosphere, probing it to below its methane clouds. A vast and deep ocean, perhaps 8,000 kilometers thick, of superheated liquid water floating in the air is inferred by some. Among the principal glories of the Uranus encounter were the pictures. With Voyager's two television cameras, we discovered 10 new moons, determined the length of the day in the clouds of Uranus, about 17 hours, and studied about a dozen rings. The most spectacular pictures were those returned from the 5 larger, previously known moons of Uranus, especially the smallest of them, Kuiper's Miranda. Its surface is a tumult of fault valleys, parallel ridges, sheer cliffs, low mountains, impact craters, and frozen floods of once molten surface material. This turmoiled landscape is unexpected for a small, cold, icy world so distant from the sun. Perhaps the surface was melted and reworked in some long-gone epoch when a gravitational resonance between Uranus, Miranda, and Ariel pumped energy from the nearby planet into Miranda's interior. Or perhaps we're seeing the results of the primordial collision that is thought to have knocked Uranus over. Or just conceivably, maybe Miranda was once utterly destroyed, dismembered, blasted into smithereens by a wild careening world, with many collision fragments still left in Miranda's orbit. The shards and remnants slowly colliding, gravitationally attracting one another, may have re-aggregated into just such a jumbled, patchy, unfinished world as Miranda is today. For me, there's something eerie about the pictures of dusky Miranda, because I can remember so well when it was only a faint point of light, almost lost in the glare of Uranus, discovered through great difficulty by dint of the astronomer's skills and patience. In only half a lifetime, it has gone from an undiscovered world to a destination whose ancient and idiosyncratic secrets have been at least partially revealed. Chapter 9. An American Ship at the Frontiers of the Solar System. By the shore of Triton's Lake, I will clear my breast of secrets. Euripides, Ion, circa 413 BC. Neptune was the final port of call on Voyager 2's grand tour of the solar system. Usually, it is thought of as the penultimate planet, with Pluto the outermost. But because of Pluto's stretched-out elliptical orbit, Neptune has lately been the outermost planet and will remain so until 1999. Typical temperatures in its upper clouds are about minus 240 degrees Celsius, because it is so far from the warming rays of the sun. It would be colder still, except for the heat welling up from its interior. Neptune glides along the hem of interstellar night. It is so far away that in its sky, the sun appears as little more than an extremely bright star. How far? So far away that it has yet to complete a single trip around the sun, a Neptunian year, since its discovery in 1846. It's so far away that it cannot be seen with the naked eye. It's so far away that it takes light, faster than which nothing can go. More than 5 hours to get from Neptune to Earth. When Voyager 2 raced through the Neptune system in 1989, its cameras, spectrometers, particle and field detectors, and other instruments were feverishly examining the planet, its moons, and its rings. The planet itself, like its cousins Jupiter, Saturn, and Uranus, is a giant. Every planet is an Earth-like world at heart, but the four gas giants wear elaborate, cumbersome disguises. Jupiter and Saturn are great gas worlds with relatively small, rocky, and icy cores. But Uranus and Neptune are fundamentally rock and ice worlds, swaddled in dense atmospheres that hide them from view. Neptune is 4 times bigger than the Earth. When we look down on its cool, austere blueness, again, we are seeing only atmosphere and clouds, no solid surface. Again, the atmosphere is made mainly of hydrogen and helium, with a little methane and traces of other hydrocarbons. There may also be some nitrogen. The bright clouds, which seem to be methane crystals, float above thick, deeper clouds of unknown composition. From the motion of the clouds, we discovered fierce winds approaching the local speed of sound. A great dark spot was found, curiously at almost the same latitude as the great red spot on Jupiter. The azure color seems appropriate for a planet named after the god of the sea. Surrounding this dimly lit, chilly, stormy, remote world is, here also, a system of rings, each composed of innumerable orbiting objects, ranging in size from the fine particles in cigarette smoke to small trucks. Like the rings of the other Jovian planets, those of Neptune seem to be evanescent. It is calculated that gravity and solar radiation will disrupt them in much less than the age of the solar system. If they are destroyed quickly, we must see them only because they were made recently. But how can rings be made? The biggest moon in the Neptune system is called Triton. Nearly 6 of our days are required for it to orbit Neptune, which, alone among big moons in the solar system, it does in the opposite direction to which its planet spins. Clockwise, if we say Neptune rotates counterclockwise. Triton has a nitrogen-rich atmosphere somewhat similar to Titan's, but because the air and haze are much thinner, we can see its surface. The landscapes are varied and splendid. This is a world of ices, nitrogen ice, methane ice, probably underlain by more familiar water ice and rock. There are impact basins, which seem to have been flooded with liquid before refreezing. So there once were lakes on Triton. Impact craters, long crisscrossing valleys, vast plains covered by freshly fallen nitrogen snow. Puckered terrain that resembles the skin of a cantaloupe. And, more or less parallel, long dark streaks that seem to have been blown by the wind and then deposited on the icy surface. Despite how sparse Triton's atmosphere is, about 1/10,000th the thickness of the Earth's. All the craters on Triton are pristine, as if stamped out by some vast milling device. There are no slumped walls or muted relief. Even with the periodic falling and evaporation of snow, it seems that nothing has eroded the surface of Triton in billions of years. So the craters that were gouged out during the formation of Triton must have all been filled in and covered over by some early global resurfacing event. Triton orbits Neptune in the opposite direction to Neptune's rotation. Unlike the situation with the Earth and its moon, and with most of the large moons in the solar system. If Triton had formed out of the same spinning disk that made Neptune, It ought to be going around Neptune in the same direction that Neptune rotates. So Triton was not made from the original local nebula around Neptune, but arose somewhere else, perhaps far beyond Pluto, and was by chance gravitationally captured when it passed too close to Neptune. This event should have raised enormous solid body tides in Triton, melting the surface and sweeping away all the past topography. In some places, the surface is as bright and white as freshly fallen Antarctic snows and may offer a skiing experience unrivaled in all the solar system. Elsewhere, there's a tint ranging from pink to brown. One possible explanation? Freshly fallen snows of nitrogen, methane, and other hydrocarbons are irradiated by solar ultraviolet light and by electrons trapped in the magnetic field of Neptune through which Triton plows. We know that such irradiation will convert the snows, like the corresponding gases, to complex, dark, reddish organic sediments, ice tholins. Nothing alive, but here too composed of some of the molecules implicated in the origin of life on Earth 4 billion years ago. In local winter, layers of ice and snow build up on the surface. Our winters, mercifully, are only 4% as long. Through the spring, they are slowly transformed, more and more reddish organic molecules accumulating. By summertime, the ice and snow have evaporated. The gases so released migrate halfway across the planet to the winter hemisphere, and there cover the surface with ice and snow again. But the reddish organic molecules do not vaporize and are not transported. A lag deposit. They are next winter covered over by new snows, which are in turn irradiated, and by the following summer the accumulation is thicker. As time goes on, substantial amounts of organic matter are built up on the surface of Triton, which may account for its delicate color markings. The streaks begin in small, dark source regions, perhaps when the warmth of spring and summer heats subsurface volatile snows. As they vaporize, gas comes gushing out as in a geyser, blowing off less volatile surface snows and dark organics. Prevailing low-speed winds carry away the dark organics, which slowly sediment out of the thin air, are deposited on the ground, and generate the appearance of the streaks. This, at least, is one reconstruction of recent Tritonian history. Triton may have large seasonal polar caps of smooth nitrogen ice underlying layers of dark organic materials. Nitrogen snows seem recently to have fallen at the equator. Snowfalls, geysers, wind-blown organic dust, and high-altitude hazes were entirely unexpected on a world with so thin an atmosphere. Why is the air so thin? Because Triton is so far from the sun. Were you somehow to pick this world up and move it into orbit around Saturn, the nitrogen and methane ices would quickly evaporate. A much denser atmosphere of gaseous nitrogen and methane would form, and radiation would generate an opaque tholin haze. It would become a world very like Titan. Conversely, if you move Titan into orbit about Neptune, almost all its atmosphere would freeze out as snows and ices. The tholin would fall out and not be replaced. The air would clear, and the surface would become visible in ordinary light. It would become a world very like Triton. These two worlds are not identical. The interior of Titan seems to contain much more ice than that of Triton, and much less rock. Titan's diameter is almost twice that of Triton. Still, if placed at the same distance from the sun, they would look like sisters. Alan Stern of the Southwest Research Institute suggests that they are two members of a vast collection of small worlds rich in nitrogen and methane that formed in the early solar system. Pluto, yet to be visited by a spacecraft, appears to be another member of this group. Many more may await discovery beyond Pluto. The thin atmospheres and icy surfaces of all these worlds are being irradiated by cosmic rays, if nothing else, and nitrogen-rich organic compounds are being formed. It looks as if the stuff of life is sitting not just on Titan, but throughout the cold, dimly lit outer reaches of our planetary system. Another class of small objects has recently been discovered whose orbits take them, at least part of the time, beyond Neptune and Pluto. Sometimes called minor planets or asteroids, they are more likely to be inactive comets, with no tails, of course. So far from the sun, their ices cannot readily vaporize. But they are much bigger than the run-of-the-mill comets we know. They may be the vanguard of a vast array of small worlds that extends from the orbit of Pluto halfway to the nearest star. The innermost province of the Oort comet cloud, of which these new objects may be members, is called the Kuiper Belt, after my mentor, Gerard Kuiper, who first suggested that it should exist. Short-period comets, like Halley's, arise in the Kuiper Belt, respond to gravitational tugs, sweep into the inner part of the solar system, grow their tails, and grace our skies. Back in the late 19th century, these building blocks of worlds, then mere hypotheses, were called planetesimals. The flavor of the word is, I suppose, something like that of infinitesimals. You need an infinite number of them to make anything. It's not quite that extreme with planetesimals, although a very large number of them would be required to make a planet. For example, trillions of bodies, each a kilometer in size, would be needed to coalesce to make a planet with the mass of the Earth. Once, there were much larger numbers of worldlets in the planetary part of the solar system. Most of them are now gone, ejected into interstellar space, fallen into the sun, or sacrificed in the great enterprise of building moons and planets. But out beyond Neptune and Pluto, the discards, the leftovers that were never aggregated into worlds, may be waiting. A few largish ones in the 100-kilometer range, and stupefying numbers of kilometer-sized and smaller bodies, peppering the outer solar system all the way out to the Oort cloud. In this sense, there are planets beyond Neptune and Pluto, but they are not nearly as big as the Jovian planets or even Pluto. Larger worlds may, for all we know, also be hiding in the dark beyond Pluto, worlds that can properly be called planets. The farther away they are, the less likely it is that we would have detected them. They cannot lie just beyond Neptune, though. Their gravitational tugs would have perceptibly altered the orbits of Neptune and Pluto, and the Pioneer 10 and 11 and Voyager 1 and 2 spacecraft. The newly discovered cometary bodies, with names like 1992 QB, and 1993 FW, are not planets in this sense. If our detection threshold has just encompassed them, many more of them probably remain to be discovered in the outer solar system, so far away that they're hard to see from Earth, so distant that it's a long journey to get to them. But small, quick ships to Pluto and beyond are within our ability. It would make good sense to dispatch one by Pluto and its moon Charon, and then, if we can, to make a close pass by one of the denizens of the Kuiper comet belt. The rocky, Earth-like cores of Uranus and Neptune seem to have accreted first and then gravitationally attracted massive amounts of hydrogen and helium gas from the ancient nebula out of which the planets formed. Originally, they lived in a hailstorm. Their gravities were just sufficient to eject icy worldlets when they came too close, far out beyond the realm of the planets, to populate the Oort comet cloud. Jupiter and Saturn became gas giants by the same process, but their gravities were too strong to populate the Oort cloud. Ice worlds that came close to them were gravitationally pitched out of the solar system entirely, destined to wander forever in the great dark between the stars. So the lovely comets that on occasion rouse us humans to wonder and to awe, that crater the surfaces of inner planets and outer moons, and that now and then endanger life on Earth, would be unknown and unthreatening had Uranus and Neptune not grown to be giant worlds 4.5 billion years ago. This is a place for a brief interlude on planets far beyond Neptune and Pluto, planets of other stars. Many nearby stars are surrounded by thin disks of orbiting gas and dust, often extending to hundreds of astronomical units, AU, from the local star. The outermost planets, Neptune and Pluto, are about 40 AU from our sun. Younger sun-like stars are much more likely to have disks than older ones. In some cases, there's a hole in the center of the disk, as in a phonograph record. The hole extends out from the star to perhaps 30 or 40 AU. This is true, for example, for the disks surrounding the stars Vega and Epsilon Eridani. The hole in the disk surrounding Beta Pictoris extends to only 15 AU from the star. There is a real possibility that these inner dust-free zones have been cleaned up by planets that recently formed there. Indeed, this sweeping out process is predicted for the early history of our planetary system. As observations improve, perhaps we will see telltale details in the configuration of dust and dust-free zones that will indicate the presence of planets too small and dark to be seen directly. Spectroscopic data suggest that these disks are churning and that matter is falling in on the central stars, perhaps from comets formed in the disk, deflected by the unseen planets, and evaporating as they approach too close to the local sun. Because planets are small and shine by reflected light, they tend to be washed out in the glare of the local sun. Nevertheless, many efforts are now underway to find fully formed planets around nearby stars. By detecting a faint, brief dimming of starlight as a dark planet interposes itself between the star and the observer on Earth, or by sensing a faint wobble in the motion of the star as it's tugged first one way and then another by an otherwise invisible orbiting companion. Spaceborne techniques will be much more sensitive. A Jovian planet going around a nearby star is about a billion times fainter than its sun. Nevertheless, a new generation of ground-based telescopes that can compensate for the twinkling in the Earth's atmosphere may soon be able to detect such planets in only a few hours observing time. A terrestrial planet of a neighboring star is 100 times fainter still, but it now seems that comparatively inexpensive spacecraft above the Earth's atmosphere might be able to detect other Earths. None of these searches has succeeded yet, but we are clearly on the verge of being able to detect at least Jupiter-sized planets around the nearest stars, if there are any to be found. A most important and serendipitous recent discovery is of a bona fide planetary system around an unlikely star some 1,300 light-years away, found by a most unexpected technique. The pulsar, designated B1257+12, is a rapidly rotating neutron star, an unbelievably dense sun, the remnant of a massive star that suffered a supernova explosion. It spins at a rate measured to impressive precision, once every 0.00062185319388187 seconds. This pulsar is pushing 10,000 RPM. Charged particles trapped in its intense magnetic field generate radio waves that are cast across the Earth, about 160 flickers a second. Small but discernible changes in the flash rate were tentatively interpreted by Alexander Volchan, now at Pennsylvania State University, in 1991, as a tiny reflex motion of the pulsar in response to the presence of planets. In 1994, the predicted mutual gravitational interactions of these planets were confirmed by Volchan from a study of timing residuals at the microsecond level over the intervening years. The evidence that these are truly new planets and not starquakes on the neutron star surface or something is now overwhelming, or as Volchan put it, irrefutable. A new solar system is unambiguously identified. Unlike all the other techniques, the pulsar timing method makes close-in terrestrial planets comparatively easy and more distant Jovian planets comparatively difficult to detect. Planet C, some 2.8 times more massive than the Earth, orbits the pulsar every 98 days at a distance of 0.47 astronomical units, AU. Planet B, with about 3.4 Earth masses, has a 67 Earth day year at 0.36 AU. Remember, the Earth, by definition, is 1 AU from its star, the Sun. A smaller world, Planet A, still closer to the star, with about 0.015 Earth masses, is at 0.19 AU. Crudely speaking, Planet B is roughly at the distance of Mercury from our Sun. Planet C is midway between the distances of Mercury and Venus, and interior to both of them is Planet A, roughly the mass of the Moon, at about half Mercury's distance from our Sun. Whether these planets are the remnants of an earlier planetary system that somehow survived the supernova explosion that produced the pulsar, or whether they formed the resulting circumstellar accretion disk subsequent to the supernova explosion, we do not know. But in either case, we have now learned that there are other Earths. The energy put out by B1257+12 is about 4.7 times that of the Sun. But unlike the Sun, most of this is not in visible light, but in a fierce hurricane of electrically charged particles. Suppose that these particles impinge on the planets and heat them. Then even a planet at 1 AU would have a surface around 280 Celsius degrees above the normal boiling point of water, greater than the temperature of Venus. These dark and broiling planets do not seem hospitable for life. But there may be others, farther from B1257+12, that are. Hints of at least one cooler outer world in the B1257+12 system exist. Of course, we don't even know that such worlds would retain their atmospheres. Perhaps any atmospheres were stripped away in the supernova explosion if they date back that far. But we do seem to be detecting a recognizable planetary system. Many more are likely to become known in coming decades. Around ordinary sun-like stars as well as white dwarfs, pulsars, and other end states of stellar evolution. Eventually, we will have a list of planetary systems, each perhaps with terrestrials and Jovians and maybe new classes of planets. We'll examine these worlds spectroscopically and in other ways. We will be searching for new Earths and other life. On none of the worlds in the outer solar system did Voyager find signs of life, much less intelligence. There was organic matter galore, the stuff of life, the premonitions of life, perhaps. But as far as we could see, no life. There was no oxygen in their atmospheres and no gases profoundly out of chemical equilibrium, as methane is in the Earth's oxygen. Many of the worlds were painted with subtle colors, but none with such distinctive, sharp absorption features as chlorophyll provides over much of the Earth's surface. On very few worlds was Voyager able to resolve details as small as a kilometer across. By this standard, it would not have detected even our own technical civilization had it been transplanted to the outer solar system. But for what it's worth, we found no regular patterning, no geometrization, no passion for small circles, triangles, squares, or rectangles. There were no constellations of steady points of light on the night hemispheres. There were no signs of a technical civilization reworking the surface of any of these worlds. The Jovian planets are prolific broadcasters of radio waves, generated in part by the abundant trapped and beamed charged particles in their magnetic fields, in part by lightning, and in part by their hot interiors. But none of this emission has the character of intelligent life, or so it seems to the experts in the field. Of course, our thinking may be too narrow. We may be missing something. For example, there is a little carbon dioxide in the atmosphere of Titan, which puts its nitrogen-methane atmosphere out of chemical equilibrium. I think the CO2 is provided by the steady pitter-patter of comets falling into Titan's atmosphere. But maybe not. Maybe there's something on the surface, unaccountably generating CO2 in the face of all that methane. The surfaces of Miranda and Triton are unlike anything else we know. There are vast, chevron-shaped landforms and crisscrossing straight lines that even sober planetary geologists once mischievously described as highways. We think we barely understand these landforms in terms of faults and collisions, but of course we might be wrong. The surface stains of organic matter, sometimes, as on Triton, delicately hued, are attributed to charged particles producing chemical reactions in simple hydrocarbon ices, generating more complex organic materials, and all this having nothing to do with the intermediation of life. But of course, we might be wrong. The complex pattern of radiostatic bursts and whistles that we receive from all four Jovian planets seems, in a general way, explicable by plasma physics and thermal emission. Much of the detail is not yet well understood. But of course, we might be wrong. We have found nothing on dozens of worlds so clear and striking as the signs of life found by the Galileo spacecraft in its passages by the Earth. Life is a hypothesis of last resort. You invoke it only when there's no other way to explain what you see. If I had to judge, I would say that there's no life on any of the worlds we've studied, except, of course, our own. But I might be wrong. And right or wrong, my judgment is necessarily confined to this solar system. Perhaps on some new mission, We'll find something different, something striking, something wholly inexplicable with the ordinary tools of planetary science. And tremulously, cautiously, we will inch toward a biological explanation. However,